The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's very exciting to see you all. Thank you for coming. I don't have a bus with my name on it. And I know the alphabet beyond the letter J and where Russia is. Not that that's required for my line of work, so it means a lot to me that you came. There are a lot of other places you could be. Nor am I a meth head who wears a hairpiece, but I'm not bitter about my competition. I am very excited. You know, when I first wrote the proposal for my first book, The Liars Club, it contained most of the material that went through this book, to about two-thirds of this book. So, you know, I never suspected I would wind up writing three of these. The first book, if you haven't read it, The Liars Club, chronicles my turbulent adolescence. I'm described as scrappy, which is shorthand for short. My second book, Cherry, follows through my drug-sodden adolescence. And I felt obligated to connect the dots for my readers between kind of the wound and the healing, between the difficulty and the solution, because I'm a marginally functional human unit, a lot of people had this idea that you could come from a very heroically or gothically strange childhood, you know, which is, as I've said before, a dysfunctional family, anybody with more than one person. But and just kind of go zippity-doo-dah down literary lane, and that's, you know, and so people had a sense of me as being somehow strong or just innately resilient. And I had a lot of help. I always say that booksellers and librarians, teachers and mental health professionals saved my life. And I would like to thank tonight Joseph Fox Bookshop for being here to sell books afterwards. Thank you. One of the great bookstores in the country. And you know, this book begins when I climb in this truck with this herd of surfers and heads and drug dealers. If you've read Cherry, you might remember. And we've taken a surfboard and scooped out the middle and put in bricks of pot and then fiberglassed over that. And we're heading from East Texas to California, of course, because all the loose marbles roll west. And I had this great idea at that moment. I was 17 years old and probably high, but I had this terrific idea that I could walk away from that house for my mother. How do I describe my mother? My mother married seven times. It was enough. I asked her once, at what point do you say, maybe it's not them? Is it number four? Or do you kind of know that all along and just keep rolling over them? But I thought I could outrun her. I thought I could just drive away from that house and reinvent myself as a writer, of course, which at that time involved, you know, wearing black clothes and smoking marijuana and not doing much, wandering around libraries. But my mother was a shadow stitched to my feet, and I couldn't outrun her. Although a couple of great things happened to me that this book covers. When I was in graduate school, or shortly after, I met this 6'5" Harvard hockey player who looked like something you win at a raffle. He actually resembled a guy who played Superman, you know, and the young Superman, not the older one. And he could quote more Shakespeare than anyone I know. And when my sister met him, she said, he might as well walk out with his hands up. It is over for him. But he had even more subtle qualities that were not apparent to me, but that somehow I must have sensed. Like when he took me home to see his parents, we head through these big steel gates with gold leaf at the top. And we pass a stables and a polo field and a tennis court. And I said, is this a subdivision? And he said, no, this is my house. And I said, why didn't you tell me about all this? And he said, about all what? Which in some ways, you know, made him the perfect husband for me. He was going to have to ignore a lot. So we get to this place, and the first thing that seemed odd was that they had this dog named Tiger, who, as I understood, had been married 5 years, or, you know, 20 years before. Well, when Tiger 1 died, they got Tiger 2. When Tiger 2 died, they got Tiger 3. They had created a universe in which the dog never died. And then at dinner, we sat at this long, glossy table with my sort of whippet-thin mother-in-law at one end and my tweedy father-in-law-to-be, that we weren't married yet, at the other end. And at one point, he sent the maid to the pantry for more asparagus, and it looked like a bowling alley, this table. And I'm completely puzzled by this whole milieu. I mean, you know, we sucked the heads off crawfish. I mean, it just wasn't exactly my scene, let's say. And the maid goes to get more asparagus, and you can hear the Danish cook bellow back, tell him if he ate like a normal man, it would have been enough asparagus. And nobody's face alters a whisker. I mean, nobody moves. It's this icy fog kind of rolls the length of the table, and everyone stays there arrested with alert, intelligent expressions on their face. And I think, these people have found the solution. The average, well-bred American WASP can ignore reality better than any heroin addict. And as I said, this guy was going to have to ignore a lot. God love him. Now, you would think with a mother that married 7 times, you would think that I would have a little help planning the wedding. But my mother's idea about weddings, or her, she did get very enthusiastic about weddings, but it sort of excited, but it's sort of like somebody with, you know, a veteran with post-traumatic stress disorder who screams incoming, you know, out of nowhere and throws himself down. That sort of was my mother's reaction. She had been cudgeled into not drinking. Both my parents drank a lot. If you hadn't read the earlier books, she had been, and my sister and I say she didn't drink. She had a little back problem, a little Valium prescription. I think she probably had some Percocet. She had a cable subscription. So she wasn't exactly drinking, but she decides to fall off the wagon at my rehearsal dinner in Boston, where I am trying to pass as a white girl. So sort of what I thought I would like to do, if you guys don't mind, is read for a shorter period of time and then have a longer Q&A. Although if you get bored, I'll talk about other things. I have other things in the hamper to talk about. But okay, the occasion for Mother falling off the wagon is the afternoon of my rehearsal dinner at the Ritz in Boston, where my father-in-law-to-be has kept a tab since law school. Before the dinner, I'm lying in a shampoo chair with my head in the black sink, neck arched up in a perfect position to have my throat cut, when I catch a distant whiff of marijuana. Mother, I think. I ask my stylist, Richard, who's closed the shop for us, do you smell that? I say, what? He says, pot, I say. He lifts his nose in the air, gives a stuffed-up snuffle, says, allergies. It's dusk. I've warned Richard and his beautician colleague, Curtis, in advance not to offer Mother and me their usual convivial glass of champagne. Curtis can't afford marijuana, Richard says. It's probably floating up from the alley. Not long after, Curtis swans in, giving off an odor of patchouli oil as he rifles a drawer. He says, your mom's a riot. I'm going to visit her in Texas. She knows a place I can buy ostrich skin cowboy boots. I'm sure she does, I say. Sometime later, when Curtis presents her, I see he's jacked her hair up into a concoction that only a drag queen could relish. Her eyes are glassy. Her neck has that bobble-headed swivel. Mother, I say, don't I look precious? She says, hands on her hips. You look high. Do you think, Curtis says, she made me do it that high. Mother tips her head coquettishly, which with the giant hairdo has the effect of a topiary starting to tip over. She says, we smoked a little Mary Jane. Then we're in Warren's tiny back seat. As he navigates the river road traffic to the Ritz, I'm violently trying to de-escalate Mother's hair. Ow, she says. She's holding her ears as I tug. You reek of marijuana, I say. The city of Cambridge is sliding away. I apologize to Warren as I work at the vast rat's nest of her head. I don't smell anything, he says. With Warren, you can never know if this is impeccable denial or politeness. I stop yanking at her hair and notice at one point the buildings of Harvard, carved from various fine types of stone, slipping by like a kingdom I'll never gain the keys to. The whole city is so profoundly Caucasian. One of its signature foods is actually a slab-like white fish devoid of all flavor. Even its basketball team is thick with knobby-jointed white Midwestern farm boys. You guys remember those guys, Larry Bird and Kevin McHale? Whose pasty torsos evoke the aforementioned fish. I'd never seen so many white people on a basketball team in my life. Mother tries to catch Warren's eye in the rearview mirror. Do I look bad, she says. You got in the back so quickly I couldn't see you, he says. His eyes are fixed on the lights of Boston. Master of diplomacy, I say. Warren, can you hand me my purse, she says. I'll find the Shalimar. I suggest we stop for some Visine. Maybe a little mouthwash. It'll make us late, he says. Still, he pulls up outside a bodega and leaves us in the huffing car. Seeing his runner's form in the unfamiliar structure of a suit brings a surge of ardor. Soon as he's out of sight, Mother says, Larry and I share a glass of wine every now and then when we go out dancing. Larry, being the somewhat prissy young man of color, hired to help take care of my daddy. My father's bedridden with a stroke for going on his fifth year, paralyzed. And this has become her paramour, my father's gay, drug-addicted nurse, who wore, I'm not kidding, he had a pair of hot pink velvet bell-bottoms, worthy of Willy Wonka. The idea of Larry and Mother drinking and dancing gives me a sick feeling in my chest. I look toward the door Warren disappeared through. His presence is an antivenin to the snake bite of Mother's disarray. Warren gets back in the car. He hands me a small paper bag over his shoulder. I fish through it for eye drops. Mother has her Shalimar out. She's studying the cap for where the nozzle is. I tell her they'll be unfailingly polite. They always are. She squirts behind her ear, and the scent of rose adder touches some reptilian area of my brain, where lies whatever faint recollection of beauty I have. Warren, she says, you know what they say a mother-in-law's job is at a wedding? I don't, he says. He pushes up his glasses. Just shut up and wear beige. He actually snorts at the unlikelihood of this. I take no comfort in sharing anxiety with my once towering mother, for any ways we favor each other on this night feel distinctly unbridled. Still, I show her my throat, adding, make me smell like you. Then we draw up into the gilded light of the Ritz, and the doorman helps me out. We enter the paneled bar to find the Whitbreads, plural, six siblings, two daughters-in-law, one son-in-law scattered among the low tables. Taken together, they're the tallest people in the room, possibly the best-looking, certainly the best-educated. A martini lands before me and gets tossed down. Drinking, to handle the angst of mother's drinking, caused by her angst, means that our twin dipsomanias face off like a pair of mirrors. One generation offloading misery to the other through dwindling generations back through history to when humans first fermented grapes. The next thing I know, Lisa grabs my arm as we stride up the stairs, saying, "What is she on?" Then we're seated at enormous tables, draped with enough linen to clothe a convent. But ultimately, it doesn't matter that my mother-in-law sobs through much of the meal, not, I'm guessing, from joy. Warren's oldest brother says with genuine puzzlement as we head down the grand staircase, "Was she crying?" And I think, how did these people do this? Nor does it matter that Mother offered to paint Mr. Whitbread in the nude and, quote, "fix anything you need fixed," close quote. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. There are microphones that swarm around, so raise your paw, and if you can wait for the microphone, it makes everybody hear you better. Here you come. Hello. You're so brave to be the first. Oh, I thought you were going to ask a question. There's a human there in a cowboy hat. I think that person needs to be... Oh, you know what? You'll have facial features again if I wear these. There you are.
You didn't talk yet about going Catholic. I want to hear about it.
You want to hear... Okay, I converted to Catholicism. It's true. When I was newly single, my son came into my room one Saturday morning or Sunday morning and said, "I want to go to church." And I was reading the Times and I said, "Why?" And he said, probably the only sentence he could have said to get me to go, he said, "To see if God's there." And I thought, well, you know, I got up and I called someone I knew who went to the Episcopal Church, and we started a kind of saga that I called God-a-rama, where we went from place of worship to place of worship. Basically, anyone who had a spiritual practice of any kind who would take us to their temple or church or zendo, we'd go with them. And my colleague was a writer named Tobias Wolff. Anybody know Toby's work? Yeah, great memoirist, great short story writer. I saw Toby 3 times a week, and I socialized with him 2 times a month, and it never occurred to me to ask Toby because he went to the Catholic Church, and that's laughable. Are becoming Catholic. So, I mean, when I went to all these places, I carried a paperback and a mug of coffee, the way I did to soccer. You know, when he played soccer, my son played soccer, which I also didn't like. And what I think happened was that I wound up writing an article about this because for Vogue magazine, or Vague magazine, as I think of it, which I buy for the picture, for the articles, right? I wrote about this, and I think some bunch of nuns was in the same dentist office, and they started praying the rosary and, like, putting some voodoo whammy on us. And because after, it took me a couple of years, but I stopped bringing a paper back, and I somehow got lured into this crazy, sexist, medieval cult. Which I'm really fond of now. I've become, yeah, I'm sure I'm not the Pope's favorite Catholic. But who is? There's a young woman there in the scarf.
Interesting, as a Catholic, I was brought up as one. What's your position on abortion then?
I'm pro-choice.
Thank you.
The church isn't. You know, I mean, if they think we shouldn't kill anything that's alive, you know, cancer's alive. Yeah, cancer's alive. Do we want to kill that? I mean, arguably. So, this one, young woman right here.
I guess I'm curious about, after your God-a-rama, what was it about Catholicism versus Buddhism or another religion that hooked you?
Well, I think a couple of things. The carnality of the church. It wasn't the ritual. You know, Walter Pater, famous art critic, from wrote a book called The Renaissance, loved the aesthetic brouhaha, and I don't like that. That stuff seems kind of like a football rally or something to me. But it was the carnality of it, the fact that there's an actual body on the cross, that you kneel and stand up and move your hands and you breathe in and out and sing things and say things. And there's also a moment in the Mass that I find is really my favorite moment, which where you state your intentions. And in smaller parishes, people call out what they want you to pray for. And people bring their suffering and their hope. And they say, you know, I'd like you to pray for my son who's having a surgery, or pray in Thanksgiving for my daughter just came back from Afghanistan. Or I found that very moving. So it was really much more the faith of the people and the tradition of their working with the poor. Now, of course, every faith has a tradition of work of charity. You know, they're not the only people. I don't know. I just felt drawn to do it. It's a long story. For $26, you can know all about it. Yes, ma'am, the lady in the red blouse. You know, they have a little step here that they don't tell you about. Do y'all see? Does anybody ever go? Has anybody ever been here before? If I drank, I wouldn't make it on this thing.
I heard you speaking on NPR, and I think I heard you say that your son has never read any of your memoirs.
My son has never read any of your memoirs.
Accurate. And why is that? Is that still
true? You know, how many people take their sons to work with them all day? You know, for like, this is a 7-year event. I think, honestly, it's an interesting phenomenon. I know a lot of people who've done this, like the brothers Wolf, Jeffrey and Tobias Wolf, whose sons didn't read their memoirs either. I am the bank of mom. I'm the purveyor of waffles and Thanksgiving turkey. And he knows everything that's in the books. But I think especially, he was too young when Liars Club came out. And when Cherry came out, it's a lot about my sexual coming of age. And I think, and he was like 16, 15. And he said, I'm not comfortable reading about that. And he knew I was sexually assaulted in the first book. And I think he felt uncomfortable reading about that. But he knows everything that's in all the books, and it's just sort of, he said, I feel like I'll read them when I'm older. But I actually go over with him what's in, because I don't want you guys to know more about me or about my marriage breaking up than he does. But most of the stuff that's in all these books is, you know, family legend. It's not really secret. It seems like it should be, right? It is just with us, though, right? Yes, ma'am. This lady in the black sweater? I'm blinded by the light of my own radiance.
I don't usually ask questions, but
do you mind using the microphone?
Sure.
Thank you.
You said something at the beginning about you. Your mother was a shadow stitched to your bottom of your foot, was it?
That's the way I felt.
Okay. And so my question was, because in reading the book, that thread with your mom runs all the way through it, how different are you from your mother, and how much are you alike?
You know, this book also contains my nervous breakthrough when I was hospitalized for depression. And I liked the mental Marriott, as I call it. I liked it. I went to a pretty fancy one, and I do some volunteer work at one that's less fancy in New York City, so I know they're not always so great. But I found a very good place for me to be at the time I was there. But I remember when I was there calling my sister and saying, oh, my God, I've turned into mother. And I was sober at the time. I was 9 months sober. I didn't go crazy sober, but I kind of woke up and realized, oh, my God, I'm crazy. I'm not just drunk. I'm crazy. And I said to my sister, I think I've turned into mother. And she burst out laughing. And I said, how am I different from mother? You know, I'm creative. You know, I'm in the loony bin. And she said, you pay your taxes. My mother didn't file a tax return for 40 years. You know, she just didn't bother. The degree of my mother's caprice, my mother actually once looked at the moon and pointed at it and said, I have an earring like that. So I am not sufficiently, my narcissism, it's not that I'm not narcissistic, because let's face it, anybody who sits in a room writing about themselves for 7 years is a little introverted. But I pay my taxes. I show up. Like when I would tell my son, like, you stay right, you know, you, I will pick you up right here, you know, at this and such o'clock. Like he would show up and I would actually be there. So very different from my mother. I think my mother, God love her, she was very, as she would have said, I'm a lot of fun to be with. She was a lot of fun to be with, but very capricious. She probably had more fun than I did. There's a young man back there.
Hi.
Hello.
As a fellow Catholic, I want to say welcome aboard.
Thank you. I keep waiting for them to kick me out.
Welcome aboard the Ark.
Thank.
I'm just kidding.
Thanks.
You might get this a lot. How do you define and pronounce the word memoir?
Just like you did.
Memoir.
Memoir.
And how do you define it?
It's a book you write about yourself. I see memoir, and somebody tried to distinguish between memoir and autobiography. You know, they're both Latinate derivatives in terms of etymology, right? They're both just writing about yourself, so I don't know. I mean, some people tried to make some distinction that if you were famous and you wrote about yourself versus, you know, being a normal person. I distinguish between what I call a soundbite memoir or a kind of bad memoir. To me, those are the if you can explain the memoir, what the memoir is about in one sentence, it probably isn't worth your money. Or you might want to read it once, but you'll never reread it. Do you know what I mean? So that would be like a memoir that reads like, I got up on Thursday, you know, my mother hit me on the head with a brick. I crawled to school, you know, I came back on Friday, she hit me on the head with a brick. You know, everybody is kind of the same way all the time. And the experience is rendered to make the person's experience look as grotesque as possible, right? When in fact my idea, say, or Tobias Wolff's idea, or St. Augustine's idea for that, you know, long before all of us in the 5th century, was, I think, to make the strange experience familiar. And to, I want to create a whole world like a novel does that is worthy of being read about more than once, because there's, so the reader enters the world and has a series of feelings over the course of the reading. So nobody is all bad. Nobody is all good. And very strange experiences, you know, my mother wagging a pistol at my stepfather, when I was a kid didn't seem strange. And for me to render them as grotesque or to try to sensationalize, I mean, they did seem strange. It didn't happen every day, but you know, I dealt with it. I had a place where that stuff went. So I distinguish between what I think of as a soundbite memoir, a memoir you can say what it is, and probably will read once out of curiosity and never reread again, in a book like Nabokov's Speak Memory, or Richard Wright's Black Boy, or Woman Warrior. Or, you know, there's a new one I just read by Hilary Mantel, who just won the Booker Prize for Wolf Hall, which is, you might think you don't want to read a book about Cromwell, but you do. It's a really good, she's great. And I just read her memoir called Giving Up the Ghost, which is one of the best memoirs I've read in a long time, probably 10 years. So, this woman here.
Two things. One, I was interested in the fact that you don't seem to use quotation marks and certain things that, you know, but yet, you know, it's quite obvious that you're in a conversational mode and, you know, I always know what you're saying.
Hopefully, but you know who's talking. That's
yeah,
my goal.
But I just was wondering about that decision. And the other thing was about the, you said your mentor said that your father was knocking at the door, and
my father was knocking at the door. Oh, Etheridge Knight. Oh, yes.
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 And
I can explain. I can explain the context of that.
Thanks.
So, what was the first one? I'm over 50, and I travel a lot. Quotation marks. Oh, I know that the, you know, memory is a corrupt device, and it's kind of a nod to saying that I wasn't wearing a video camera strapped to my head. I'm recreating dialogue. but also because I think when you don't have quotation marks, there's a way in which you're in the head of the reader more. And what I want with my readers is that kind of intimacy with the experience, not where they're looking at it like you look at a Springer episode going, thank God these aren't my family, you know, even though I'm sure you say that many times. But, yeah, you say, we don't look so bad now that I think of it. We're all back from Thanksgiving. So that's my idea about the quotes. And when I was in graduate school, I tried to write a very highfalutin kind of poetry. I didn't want to be who I was, and I had a lot of references, especially to classical this's and that's, because I was undereducated, and I was trying to hide it. And Etheridge Knight was an African-American poet who was my first writing teacher, who published his first book from prison. And you can read him in the Norton Anthology or any major American poet. He's a major American poet. And I don't know how I wound up being lucky enough to work with him. But he thought that I needed to write more out of my heart. And that's mostly what I do. I try to write what I'm passionate about. It's not really a new idea, but it was new to me. Yes, ma'am, this woman here.
Hi. Just a question in terms of your book, your new book that you're talking about tonight. I was just wondering why you chose that particular excerpt from the book, if there was...
Why I chose that excerpt from the book? Well, I think funny is good in this environment. I think people don't like being read to, even smart people. And, I mean, I've been going to poetry readings since I was 17 years old, and I think shorter is better. And I also am more interested in you guys, believe it or not, than myself. So I felt it was a passage that showed some of the issues in the book between my mother and my trying to become a wife and mother myself. Some of the issues I faced without giving away too much. It was early enough in the book that it wouldn't give away too much, make the book less, possibly less fun to read. So I hoped it was funny and or at least lighter. Do you think it was a good idea or bad idea? You have another idea? My Catholicism. If I could have talked more about my Catholicism. Well, let me talk about that just for a minute then. When I start sounding like Ornstein or something, you know, like, put your hand up and I'll testify. Somebody goes, stop, Mayor, you're messing up. But when I was, I couldn't stop drinking. It was so weird. I'd always been able to stop drinking, and I couldn't stop drinking, and I felt myself morphing into my mother. I was the lady yelling at her toddler, you know, in the market, and I was horrified, and I just couldn't quit. It was so weird. And I kept talking to other people who'd been able to quit and not being able to quit, and someone suggested I pray. I was an atheist my whole life. My father said, you know, Jesus was a trick on poor people. My mother was, you know, every now and then she'd do yoga or something, even in the 60s before people did it, but she was not big into Jesus. If anything, she was more interested in Buddhism. And I was very cynical about it. And someone said, why don't you pray every day on your knees for 30 days? I had just almost driven into something with more molecular density than I have. It's a big rock in the middle of the road, and just barely escaped death. You know, the car spun out, and it was not a good scene. And so I was teachable. Somebody said, why don't you pray on your knees morning and night and see if you stay sober and see if your life gets better. And I said, what kind of God wants you to pray on your knees? And the woman, who was actually a former heroin addict, said, you don't do it for God, you asshole. I said, well, then who do you do it for? I don't want to do it. And she said, you do it to remind yourself all the things you don't have any control over. And to remind yourself your place in the universe. God doesn't want you groveling. It's not about God. That's what I mean about the carnality of the church. That so much of it is do it by rote and see if the feeling came. And that had worked for me somehow. So I stayed sober. I didn't think, thank you, baby Jesus, and, you know, start to testify. But I started taking spiritual suggestions. After I found myself in the Mental Marriott, someone suggested to me a couple of things. She said, you know, all these things you're afraid of, because I was a very fearful person. I still have a big startle reflex, but I'm not so fearful. But she said, what if the solution to all your problems were a spiritual solution? And this is a woman who is a Harvard social theorist. She was no numbskull. And very smart woman. And it just struck me, like, what do I have to lose to try doing this stuff? It's interesting, because you think of yourself as losing something, like you're giving something up. It really feels that way. And a lot of times I would just kneel, and I think because I didn't have any program, I would just shoot the finger at the light fixture and tell God, you know, what an amateur he was and how pissed I was, you know, that my daddy drank himself to death, and how, you know, mad I was that I'd been raped when I was a little kid. And, you know, I mean, I did. I just talked, you know. And I think in a strange way, my candor made me feel, and then I had these very weird things happen, which a secular person would call coincidence. That's fine. You're probably not wrong. So the first 3 weeks I was praying, I had prayed for 3 weeks, and this same person said, what do you want? What are you praying for? I said, I pray to stay sober. I say, thank you for keeping me sober. She said, well, what do you want? I said, I want money. Like, do you pray for money? And she's like, well, why not? I said, okay, I'll pray for money. And I said, I want to stay sober, and I want some money. I would like to make $25,000 a year. I was teaching 6 sections of composition at 3 universities in the academic ghetto around Boston, Tufts, Harvard, Emerson. And I would like to make $25,000 a year. I don't need health insurance since Warren has it. So I, you know, kind of... I just laid it out there, and 3 weeks later, a guy called me and said, we're giving you $35,000 for a grant I had never applied for. Now, I said to this same person, she said, well, you have a lot to be, you were praying for money, somebody gave you has anybody ever called you and given you $35,000? I said, I couldn't get bail money from my mother. You know, no. I mean, you know what my mother sent me for my birthday that year? 3 boxes of shrink-wrapped hamburger helper. Swear to God. And only my sister knew. And she said, I'm the only one who knows. You're glad to get it. I was happy. So I had some things like that happen that were very odd to me. And this person said, you're 100%. I said, look, they must have started the grant process. Somebody else nominated me. I didn't apply. They started the grant process probably 8 months ago, blah, 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 blah. So it's not like I said these prayers over the past 3 weeks. Over the past 3 weeks, they made this. Yeah, but they met over the past week. And she says, so you're 100% sure that nothing you said in another room in another state could influence anything that happened elsewhere? I said, yeah. She said, 100%. I said, 99.999. She said, so you believe a little bit. And that, for me, was really how incremental it was. But I did do I did centering prayer where you count your breaths to 10, 1 to 10, morning and night. So I started, just anybody I knew who looked less crazy than I was, who's pretty much anybody, as it turned out, who did anything vaguely voodoo, hippie, any new age, I didn't care, or even religious, I would try. So it was a very incremental, and I'd been doing that for 6 years and had I would have said that I wouldn't have used the G word. I wouldn't have said God. The Catholics would have said I believed in the Holy Spirit. I believed in a force for good, you know, kind of the happy, hippie, secular humanist groovy, kumbaya, we all love each other, we don't eat our babies when we're hungry, and people are nice, and there's a force for good in the world. So I would have said I believed in that. But now I believe in, like, the resurrection. I believe in all kinds of nutty Catholic stuff. Although I told my priest I still don't believe the Pope is the ultimate religious authority. And he said, maybe you will someday. Because I don't think he does either, so... And there's a woman right there. Do I sound like Joel Ornstein when I talk like this? Really? It's okay? Because I'm almost embarrassed to drag people not in, you know. It's, talking to a secular audience about your spiritual practice is doing card tricks on the radio, so.
Are there things that you see or hear during the day in your daily life that inspire your work?
Yes. There are things that I see or hear during the day that inspire my work. Do you mean while I'm sitting writing or when I'm moving around?
No, just going through your day.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually pray a lot now. I mean, I don't pray like the Carthusians pray or Trappist or anybody in Berry.
No, I didn't mean in terms of prayer. I just meant as you live your life now.
Oh, yeah. Did things inspire me?
Right.
Yeah.
Towards writing away from your family, or are you going to...
Oh, am I going to write? Oh, no. I mean, people just look interesting to me. But I do pray about what to write. I turned down a huge amount of money for this book in 2000. Huge amount of money. And I needed it for college tuition. And so I do actually decide what to write. So Jesus told me to write this book. But unlike Oprah, I didn't do it to help any of you. I did it for the money. It's true. I did it for the money. And God knows that. And God knows. Anybody else? Oh, right here.
Connected to what you just said, you in the interview in the Inquirer today, you mentioned that you write these books so that you can keep body and soul together and so that you can write poetry.
Right. If they didn't pay me to do this, I would not do this. That is the God's honest truth. And they have paid me more every time, which I like. And they don't. But at one point, I threw away over 1,000 pages of this book. And that's the other thing I think about the soundbite memoirs. I think they're really written for the writer instead of for the reader. People think it's about them getting their experience down, and I'm, you know. But I threw away 1,000 pages twice, 500 pages twice. And in January of 2008, I despaired of finishing this book. And they're very interested once they've given you money. And I was, like, 4 years late, and they frown on that. And at one point, I said to my publisher and my agent, I will sell this apartment, I live in New York, and give you guys back the money before I will publish a crappy book because you've got a gun to my head. So I guess I have some pride, right? I guess I care about it. But honest to goodness, it's very hard. It's very taxing. It's emotionally taxing. It's physically taxing. And so I really do it for money. Back there, yes, ma'am.
After reading Liars Club, this may sound like an oxymoron, but I felt that your mother, or that you got certain strengths from your mother.
Absolutely.
And that's what I would like you to talk about.
Well, my mother was a lot of fun to be with. I've been told I'm a lot of fun to be with. My mother had a tremendous sensibility. I mean, she knew good art, she knew good opera, she knew good painting, she knew good blues, she knew good jazz, she knew good tacos. You know, she knew good Philly cheesesteak, she knew bad Philly cheesesteak. I mean, she had a very highly refined sensibility. And to some extent, I think I've devoted my life. I think if you're an artist, you devote your life to developing a sensibility that says this is better than this. And I hope that I inherited that from her. Her intellectual curiosity, she was an enormous reader. Got sober at 62, almost finished a PhD in Chinese history. Took calculus when she was 47. You know, and made an A, took 2 semesters of college calculus. I mean, that's kind of amazing. So she was better looking, but I'm a lot more reliable. So, but no, she was amazing, and I miss her every day. Every year on the day she died, my sister and I call each other and say, do you think Mother's done being dead yet? Like, does she not think we've got the idea that she's made her point? Couldn't she just come back? So I don't like her being dead. I prefer her living. But God has his mysterious plan. And this man here had his hand up.
Hi, I really enjoy Liars Club, and I'm reading Cherry right now. I was trying to cram it to be done by the time of the lecture tonight. But I didn't even know about Lit, which seems like right up my alley because I've got about 20 years sobriety. I'm the same age as you. I went through, you know, 12 years of pot every day and, you know, 20 years of drinking.
Did you have the same job the whole time? Because I did.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I've changed jobs and wives a number of times.
Yeah, good.
And my mother was a Baptist from Houston, so I really enjoyed all your stuff about
wow.
East Texas. So we've gone.
You're probably my brother.
Well, we've maybe, but we've been looking for you. What year did your mother die? Now, in any case, but we've gone the opposite directions in religion. I mean, I grew up going to church and Sunday school every Sunday, and I just get to be more of a confirmed atheist each year.
You know, I heard a really great nun very early on. Actually, I hadn't joined the church, but I was taking my son, and I heard this amazing, like, you know, these nuns come out of Africa, have been in these missions, you know, AIDS missions, and often they're very amazing. You know, you expect this kind of doddery old pre-Vatican II habit-wearing individual, and they're often very, very highly spiritually developed people. And I remember some woman in my parish saying, don't you think it's terrible? You know, she was saying how she had to get people to talk about the local gods, to get people to use condoms to prevent AIDS and et cetera, et cetera. And a very doctrinaire woman in my parish, of which there are very few, stood up and said, well, don't you think it's awful that these people, you know, will go to burn in everlasting hell, you know, because they aren't baptized? And the nun said, you know, I used to think that. She's about 86, and she said, now I think the Holy Spirit assumes many forms.
Well, my grandmother wouldn't agree with that. But
well,
in any case, enough about me. I wanted to ask you a question. I didn't
good.
To get into the autobiographical stuff. You know, in the AA rooms over the last 20 years, I've told virtually every deep, dark, ugly secret about myself.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I try to make it funny or whatever. But, mm-hmm. you know, and I tell almost total strangers lots of very personal things about
mm-hmm.
me. But I've never gone so far as to
write a book.
Publish a book.
Yeah,
and
you know what? If they gave you the money they gave me, you would.
Yeah. Well, I guess my question is.
So would everybody.
You're damn right. But the question is, you know, do you feel like do you ever feel the need or the inkling to pull any punches, or are you worried about what's, you know, how is somebody going to react
constantly
to this?
I mean, I the idea is not to put in every single thing that has ever happened to you. The idea is to have a narrative. In this case, my overcoming my aversion to my very complicated, glamorous, beautiful mother in order to become a mother myself, my becoming an alcoholic and then being able to raise a son, which I did, you know, as a single mom with help from his father, certainly. But, so I put in things that related to that narrative. But still, yes, I was very concerned about my ex-husband. I offered him a chance to vet the manuscript in advance, and he said, I prefer a pseudonym. And I did send it to our couples counselor, to the person who was a third party, just to say, does this seem fair? And she said it did. But she's still not him, obviously. But yeah, I'm very, but I have a friend who's doing this now, who's never done this before and is writing a memoir and is writing about two women he slept with. He's kind of a profligate friend. He's one of those. And still HIV negative, amazingly enough. But he's writing about these two women he slept with, and he's comparing them sexually. And I said, first off, do you ever want to get laid again in your life? No, 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 no. You know, I said, how is this relevant? He said, well, I noticed that at the time. I said, well, you also noticed Nixon was president, but you're not writing about that. You know, there are all kinds of things that happen to you that you don't put in. And I try to put in the things that are relative to the narrative. But is there some grotesque, horrible, really fascinating thing I didn't put in? Nah. No. But I didn't, You don't put, I mean, again, that you don't, it's not whoever has the worst ass-whipping writes the best memoir. That's the myth. If that were true, every Auschwitz survivor would make $1 million, so more than, selling books, yes. If you read Primo Levi's Survival at Auschwitz, Levi spends very little time talking about how bad the Nazis are. He kind of gets that we know that. What's so amazing about his book is he frames his experience in the camp in terms of his moral dilemma, his crisis, his emotional crisis. I always say, you know, it has to be some aspect of yourself. So he permits his father to starve to death because his father's giving him those few extra peas and pieces of potato every day. And even though they don't speak about it, they have a tacit agreement that this is what's happening. So, you know, Levi has an aspect of his own character that he's wrestling with over the course of the book. So I don't really write these books, and I always say to anybody writing one of these, unless the enemy is some aspect of yourself, you're not fighting the right demon. Because, however, let's say your father was Joseph Stalin and he beat you every day with a rubber hose. He also fed you. He kept a roof over your head. And you were glad to see him, and you tried to please him, and you loved him, and you gave a damn about him. And he, in some ways, matters to you because you're hardwired to have that. And so if you could just hate them when they do crazy things, it'd be easy, right? We'd all just move out when we were about 9 and get our own apartments, you know. It'd be like Peter Pan, and we'd have some island, the island of lost boys, be smoking cigars. And, oh, that was Pinocchio. There's a question here, sir. First here and then there. Yes, sir. On the front row.
Hi. Can you talk about, for you, how the poetry self and the memoir self live and work together? Like, do they give you different things? Do they give you the same thing?
I wish they gave me the same thing. I wish the memoirs were as much fun. Not really. I can't really call the poetry fun. I've never thought writing was fun. Having written is really fun for me. Writing sucks, but having written feels, you feel like, now I can go have a little something to eat. But the poetry is, I think, aesthetically much harder because you're trying to create a new shape or something every time to communicate what it is you're communicating. So the page is blank over and over again. You don't have these big projects. But I always say that poetry is informed by music and form, and prose favors information. You can't get the kind of information into poetry, into a poem. You can, but it's like, you know, farting the Star Spangled Banner through a tuba, you know. It'd be kind of interesting that you could get all that information into poetic form, but why would you bother when there's a better form, right? Is how I feel about it. This man had his hand up. The gentleman with the tie on? Yes, sir. Okay.
What about AA, Alcoholics Anonymous?
I've never said I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never spoken about Alcoholics Anonymous. As I understand it, and this is available on the Internet, as I understand it, that is an anonymous fellowship. And what that means is that if you were in it, you wouldn't tell anybody you were in it. So I've actually never mentioned AA. All kinds of reviews have said, I'm in AA. I've never said that. I've never said that since. So, yes, sir, right back there. I will do two more.
First, what went into deciding to not fictionalize the places you lived in Texas, but
why change the names?
Geographically specific. Yeah, and same with college and lit. That's question number one. Question number two is, do you have another nonfiction project that you're working on or in mind or anything?
I do. I'm working on poems right now, which are, they look like they're about New York City and sort of New York City street life, but they're about Jesus. Sort of the way C.S. Lewis wrote about Jesus, but I don't use a lion. So I'm working on those poems. I have an idea for a book about memoir that I would like to be. This is pretty fairly ambitious. Sort of like Ian Forster's Aspects of the Novel or John Gardner's On Moral Fiction. That would be kind of a serious book that's both critical and has some how-to elements to it from a practitioner's point of view. See, I can only do one thing at a time. Oh, place names. You know, I in all these books, I notify everybody who's a major character in the book who's alive before I write them, and I give them a chance to and say, you know, Mom, I'm going to be writing about your psychotic break when you tried to stab me with a butcher knife. How do you feel about that? And she's like, oh, get it off your chest. You know, but there are a lot of people I don't know as well as I know my mother, whom I'm writing about. I have here tonight, have any of you read the new book? There's a character, one of the first people who saved my life is a college professor named Walt Mink, who's very dear to me. He and his wife got me in therapy when I was 19 years old to a guy I paid $5 an hour and probably still owe $50 to. And his oldest son is here tonight. He's a pediatric neurologist. So I made a big mistake about Walt, who had a limp, and I thought it was polio-related, but it was based on I sent it to his son and the manuscript to his son, and it was actually based on a car wreck. So there are a lot of people in these books who aren't around to correct. So I don't want them, if you want to tell somebody, yeah, that's me, then you can do that. But you don't, you know, if you change the name of the town and you change details slightly, you know, I wanted people like the fire chief because the fire department was so stupid in my town and the mayor, you know, and my junior high principal who told me when I said I wanted to be a poet that I'd be no more than a common prostitute. You know, I have no reason to burn that guy's house down, so. Anyway, one more question. This lady right here.
Hi, Ms. Carr. I am a great fan of yours.
And oh, I'm so glad.
I would like to quote one of your poems on the issue of whether you write for money or not, specifically The Choice, one of my favorite poems, which I have a signed copy of. My daughter gave it to me for my...
Aww.
Yeah. And I think that you would write whether it was for money or not.
Oh, no, I write poetry. Right. I write poetry.
Okay, the memoir maybe, but yeah.
Oh, no, I love memoir form, but yes, you're absolute. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I didn't become a poet for money. Not even I was that stupid.
Okay. Right.
You know, my brother-in-law said to me this year, you know, you're not as stupid as you look. And I was like, well, I kind of couldn't be, could I? So anyway, that's it. Thank you for coming. Happy to sign your books.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.